BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. And, for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the actor Richard E. Grant. He took his first steps into the limelight in school plays while growing up in Eswatini, then called Swaziland, during the dying days of colonial rule. Opportunities to pursue his vocation there were limited, so he moved to London, rented a bedsit and took a job in a restaurant. After waiting tables and biding his time, he bagged the part of a lifetime, the title role in With Nail and I. His big screen debut began a wave of success that continues to this day. In the last few years alone, he's been Oscar nominated for his performance in the black comedy Can You Ever Forgive Me, played a dastardly Sith general in Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker, and drag queen Loco Chanel in Everybody's Talking About Jamie. Off-screen, he is a lifelong diarist, but dislikes keeping secrets, which may explain both why 3 collections of his writing have been published and their critical acclaim. He is as frank about the depth of his grief after the loss of his beloved wife Joan as he is about his enduring appetite for the acting life. He says, "I'm always excited by a new job. That's never gone away, and I think the day it does is the day you have to hang up your tights and put away your makeup." Richard E. Grant, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much. What a privilege to be on here. Honestly, I've listened to it ever since it's been going, so I never ever thought that I'd actually be sitting on the island with you. Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. So let's start with that sense of excitement, Richard. When does it hit you? Is it a first day on set thing, or is it when you get a peek at a great script for the very first time?
It's when you read the first page of a script and you know that you're compelled to read the second, third, fourth, and then get to page 110. Because as much as you think that there are brilliant scripts out there, the amount of times that you don't want to throw everything in the fire after page 5, that happens more than not.
With that in mind, as I mentioned, you were nominated for an Oscar in 2019 for your role as Jack Hawk in Can You Ever Forgive Me. Did you have a sense that that was going to be so successful when you first read the screenplay?
No, but I knew from the moment that I read it that it was something that I was very keen to do. And the first thing I said to my agent, because I was sent it, and they said, "You have 24 hours to read this and make a decision." And I said, "Why? Who's dropped out?" And they said, "Don't ask that, because it doesn't matter." "Who is in it?" They said, "Melissa McCarthy." I said, "I'm in."
And you posted the most wonderful video sharing your delight at being shortlisted for the award. That immediately went viral. It was a joy. Did the ceremony live up to your expectations?
Yes, because it was like being Madame Sassoud's for real, where every single person that you could see to left, right, centre and up, down, sideways was famous. Either somebody I had followed their entire career or was newly famous. Felt like I was in the sweetie shop of fame. I absolutely loved it.
It's time to get into the music, Richard. Mm-hmm. We're going to start with your first disc. What have you gone for?
It is Barbara Streisand singing I'm the Greatest Star from the movie soundtrack of Funny Girl.
Now, your love of Barbara Streisand is long, enduring and very much on the record. Why have you chosen this track and this version in particular?
Well, 53 years and counting. I first saw her in this movie when I was 12 years old in 1969. And because she had an unusual face, like Donald Sutherland had a very long face, and I'd seen both of them in a movie that same year, and everybody had said, "Oh, you can never be a professional actor, and certainly not coming from Swaziland," as it was then called. So these are the two people that were my kind of lodestars. I thought, well, if they can do it, and this is such a cri de coeur of impassioned wanting to be successful, you know, it's the backstage rag to riches story of comedian Fanny Brice. And I just thought that it encapsulated everything that a pre-adolescent wishing to be did. And nobody else has ever sung it like she has.
'Cause I'm the greatest star. I am by far. But no one knows. you're gonna hear a voice, a silver flute. They'll cheer each two. Hey, that kid is terrific. When I expose it. Now, can't you see to look at me that I'm a natural Camille?
Barbara Streisand and I'm the Greatest Star. And we'll return to your lifelong devotion to Barbara Streisand later, Richard. For now, I want to know a little bit more about your early life.
Okay.
So you were born in 1957 to Henrik and Leonie in what was then Swaziland. Mm-hmm. Set the scene for us.
It was a goldfish bowl in that it was hermetically sealed expat colonial life of people who, in retrospect, were very self-important about their roles in pith helmets, and there was a very, very strict pecking order in the last gasp of empire until independence came in 1968.
And it sounds like you had aspirations for a very different life from an extremely young age.
There was an amateur theatre, the Swaziland Theatre Club, and there was one cinema, and so that was it. So being in plays and seeing them there was the only theatre that I had ever been exposed to.
Did you get there very much?
Oh, yeah, I went constantly and was a junior member and was in every play that I could possibly get into, every panto.
So, Richard, as I mentioned, you've always been a great diary keeper, mm-hmm. and some collections of your diaries have been published. But I believe you were first inspired to start keeping one when you were 10. What prompted you to first put pen to paper?
I inadvertently witnessed my mother bonking my father's best friend on the front seat of a car. Late one evening, we were coming back from a cricket match, and I was obviously asleep on the back seat, and then woke up to the rhythmic movements of the car, which is something that you can well imagine. So I tried God, got no response. I obviously couldn't tell my father or my mother or my friends. So I thought that to try and understand what had happened, I started keeping a diary. And it's continued to be something that I've done every day to try and make sense of the world that I live in.
Well, I can completely understand why. So with that in mind, I think we'd better find out a little bit more about your mother, Leonie.
Yes.
Tell me about her.
She is now 91, formidable. Chain smokes, she drives herself, she plays bridge three times a week. She reads five books for a publisher that she does ad hoc work for. So she is a force of nature. And we had a great estrangement for decades. And after I had psychoanalysis when I was 42, after a breakdown, I had this breakthrough with her in that I was guided by the psychoanalyst to try and get her to reveal her narrative of what had happened, to explain why she ended up in the front seat of the car, that thing that I mentioned earlier. And I got a very, very detailed, lengthy letter written with the voice of a young woman in the colonies, having a child and dealing with a pecking order, not allowed to work, and all those kind of restrictions. And once I understood that, I then reciprocated by giving her hammer and tong of what had happened to me at the hands of my subsequently alcoholic father after she had left. So she was as astonished by that as I was by her revelations, convincing me that all secrets in families are toxic. She said three words to me when we finally had a face-to-face after these letters had been exchanged. I went out to visit her, and she leant forward on a table in a restaurant. I had never seen my mother cry before, and she said three magic words, "Please forgive me." That instantly removed all these weights and pillars of prejudice and long-standing misunderstanding that we'd had between us. So it was incredible. I now Skype her once a week.
Richard, let's hear some more music from you. Your second choice today.
It's Nat King Cole singing When I Fall in Love. And in the first 10 years of my life, when my parents' marriage seemed all right from my point of view, this very nostalgic and sentimental music sums up and conjures up that era for me.
When I fall in love, it will be forever, or I'll never fall in love. In a restless world like this is, love is ended
having thought that I would never get married when I did fall in love and then had 38 years together with my wife Joan, I felt that I'd reclaimed that song for the two of us.
It's wonderful when that happens, a kind of recalibration.
Yeah, exactly.
A very special track. When I Fall in Love by Nat King Cole. So, Richard E. Grant, we've heard about your mother. Tell me about your father, Henrik. He worked as director of education
Swaziland. Yeah, he was incredibly witty, fast-thinking, dynamic person by day. And the moment that she left him, he hit a Johnny Walker bottle a day.
Wow.
So by 9 o'clock at night, it was literally like a switch that he became a completely different character, very morose, very angry and often violent, and then told me on his deathbed at the age of 53 that he had never stopped loving my mother. And I thought he was referring to my stepmother, who just walked out of the room, and he said, no, your mother. There was this, on the one hand, an incredibly charming, articulate, provocative man by day, and then this absolute monster that would come out at night, which culminated when I was 15, when I naively thought that if I emptied all 12 bottles of scotch down the sink, that he would somehow stop drinking. And I was on the 11th bottle and felt something very cold on the back of my head, and it was a gun. Ducked, ran into the garden, and then he chased me and flicked on the garden lights, and there were pool lights as well, and found me and then got hold of me and said, I'm going to blow your brains out. And I said, go ahead and do it. Just let's get this over and done with. He missed because he was so drunk. And then I ran away from home for a couple of weeks. But having said that, my memory of him is so much more than remembering that part of him, because I knew that that was something that was, entirely brought about by addiction rather than the man that I absolutely worshipped and loved.
But so difficult to have both of those sides.
And it helped keeping a diary.
Richard, it's time for your third piece of music.
When a Man Loves a Woman by Percy Sledge. In 1970, Percy Sledge came to the Somhlolo Independence Stadium in Swaziland. No international pop star had ever visited the country before. So I went to see him and got his autograph. And when Joan and I got married on the 1st of November in 1986, it was the first song that we'd danced to at our wedding party.
Sledge and When a Man Loves a Woman. Richard E. Grant, after boarding school, you went to study drama and English at Cape Town University, and you started there in 1976, which was obviously a time of huge social and political struggle in South Africa. What was it like arriving in the city as a young student amidst all of that?
Well, having come from Swaziland, which was completely multiracial, it was a real shock going into a city and a country that, still had apartheid. But within a month of being at the university, students were rioting about not being taught in Afrikaans, black students. It felt like we were in the crucible of a revolution. And it was, for a young student as I was, I thought, well, this is it. Everything is going to change. And finally, freedom would be for everybody. Equal rights, all of that. Apartheid would be completely dismantled. I naively didn't realise, and I suppose many people didn't, that the government was so powerful that they squashed all of that for more than another decade.
And it's at 25 that you decide to make the move to London.
I had intended leaving after setting up a theatre company for a year, and then my father was diagnosed with lung cancer. So I stayed another year, and then a few months after he died, I decided to emigrate with, literally like Dick Whittington, with two suitcases and a box of cassettes and a Walkman, and came to London, rented a bedsit in Notting Hill Gate, it was £30 a week, and then worked as a waiter at a brasserie in Covent Garden, which is still there, till I started getting acting work. So I didn't really have any contacts whatsoever, but just came over with blind ambition and hope. And I gave myself till I was 30. I thought, if within 5 years I couldn't get regular employment, I'd have to go back and open up a pineapple beer stall or something in Swaziland.
It's time for your next piece of music, Richard, number four.
Oh, this is Sweet Dreams Are Made of This by the Eurythmics, which I had listened to on repeat on my Walkman when I was a waiter in January 1983, and then subsequently became friends with Annie Lennox, who I met on a chat show. And then I discovered that she'd been to the same school that Joan had been to in Aberdeen, so they all knew the teachers in common, and we subsequently have become great friends.
Dreams by Eurythmics. Richard E. Grant, early in your time in the UK, you met your future wife, Joan. She was a dialect coach, sorting out your vowels, I think.
She was. I went to the Actors' Centre where a very feisty, spike-haired, kicker-booted, boiler-suited woman called Joan Washington was doing a series of six regional accents. And after a couple of these, I said to her in the reception, I said, would you teach me privately? And she said, what for? And I said, well, to iron out my colonial accent. And she said, well, it doesn't sound too bad to me. I said, well, somebody's identified that sound like it's somebody speaking for the 1950s. So she said, all right. She said, but I'm very busy. And I said, please, I beg of you. And she laughed. I got down on my knees. And she said, oh, get up, for God's sake. And I said, how much is it going to cost? And she said, £20 an hour. And I said, oh, I can only really afford 12 because I'm paying £30 a week for my bedsit and I'm a waiter. And she said, oh, OK, we'll do it on a deal. You can have some lessons on the proviso that you pay me back if you ever make it. So she did get paid back, indeed.
So obviously the two of you got together. As you mentioned, her career was up and running, but yours took a while to take off. In fact, you hadn't worked for the best part of a year when, ironically enough, the part of Withnail, who is an out-of-work actor, came up. There was more than one irony about it. Another is that despite playing the alcoholic Withnail so yes, convincingly, you're thank allergic you to booze yourself.
Yeah, and I would have thought that, you know, with an alcoholic father, that it would be psychosomatic, and I couldn't hold alcohol down for more than 10 minutes was the longest that I'd ever managed, that being violently ill for 24 hours. And so I went to a doctor, had a blood test, and he said, you have no enzyme to process alcohol. You can never, ever drink. It's completely toxic to your system.
But what about on the set of Withnail? Because Withnail's chugging down drinks left, right and centre.
Oh, well, that's sadistic, Bruce Robinson.
That's the director of Withnail and I.
He insisted that on the final night before we did the last day of rehearsals at Shepperton Studios, before going up to Penrith, that I had to experience what it was like to be drunk. So he said, here's a bottle of champagne, go and get that down your gullet. So I did, and I threw up throughout the night and got to the rehearsals the next day. I was driven in because I was so drunk, and I managed to get through, I think, 40 minutes of the script, and Paul McGann and Bruce were laughing. I remember them laughing all the time, and I couldn't really understand why. And then I passed out.
Withnail was a huge breakthrough for you, but it did come at a very difficult moment in your personal life for you and for Joan. Just one week into the making of the film, you lost your first daughter, Tiffany. She was born prematurely and only lived for half an hour. It must have been absolutely devastating, especially as you were in the middle of this life-changing project. How did you deal with it?
The abyss of grief is something that you have to navigate your way through and around, and I don't know that you ever get over it. And I suppose there's a part of me that doesn't want to get over it, because getting over it, or people saying, oh, well, time heals everything, I don't agree with that, because it then implies that you're forgetting about that person or that you're disregarding it, whereas these things have such lasting impact on you that I never want to forget.
Richard, it's time to go to the music. Your fifth selection today. What have you got for us?
It is the Chopin Prelude, Opus 28, number 4 in E minor, and it's played by Ivo Pogorelic. It was the first concert that I went to on the South Bank when I had emigrated in the spring, summer of 1982. And he was a kind of rock god of pianist at that point, and this was a piece of music that I had on repeat after my wife died and after our daughter died, so that is why it means so much. Played so much slower than any other interpretation that I've heard.
I can see why you want to take it to the island.
Yeah.
You went somewhere completely different during that piece.
Yeah, absolutely extraordinary.
Chopin's Prelude, Opus 28, number 4 in E minor, played by Ivo Pogorelic. So, Richard, With Neil and I was the turning point for you. Ever since, you've always been in work. You've had so many professional triumphs. You've also turned your hand to directing too when you made the film Wawa, based on your childhood in Swaziland. What was it like putting your story on screen in that way?
It was the most creatively satisfying thing that I've ever done, because having been completely powerless to control anything when I was a teenager, when all these things were going on. The opening scene of the film is what I mentioned right up front, that it, you know, it was inadvertently waking up and discovering my mother in flagrante on the front seat of the car. So going back as a middle-aged man to Swaziland, where a film had never been made before, in the locations where all these events happened, I felt the writing process was painful and cathartic by turn, but actually shooting it was the most exhilarating thing that I've ever done.
It's time for some more music, Richard. What's your sixth disc?
Oh, how appropriate. It's a track called Please Forgive Me, and it's from the wonderful Pat Doyle, Glaswegian composer of the soundtrack of Wawa, my autobiographical film.
Please Forgive Me, from the film Wawa, the soundtrack composed by Patrick Doyle with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by James Shearman. So, Richard E. Grant, we know that you've kept a diary since you were 10, and you recently published a memoir, A Pocket Full of Happiness, covering your wife Joan's cancer diagnosis just before Christmas 2020, and very sadly, her death last September. It's a very tender description of your lives together. Was putting everything down on paper and sharing it in public therapeutic?
Well, the same impulse that I had in recording what had happened that I witnessed when I was 10, of feeling completely having no control over anything, when she was diagnosed, by keeping a detailed diary of what happened on a daily basis, I thought, well, I have no control over any of this, and I know that she's terminally ill, but I wanted as detailed a record of the time that we had left together, so that I would always have something that I could reread or go back to.
That's one of the strange things about dealing with a diagnosis of any kind, is the ability you have to develop overnight to live in the moment, to stay in the moment.
Absolutely.
Just as a means of survival.
Yeah.
Was that a new skill for you?
Yes, I suppose because of the nature of my job, because it's not regular, you never know what you're going to be doing next. So there's always a kind of low-level hum of anxiety of, you know, will I ever get another job, or will the job that I'm going to get be worthwhile doing, or whatever. So between COVID, where everything stopped, and we spent that historically gorgeous spring that had never happened in England before for 300 years or whatever. Spending all of that time together was an extraordinary gift. So that when she was then diagnosed at the end of that on her birthday on the 21st of December 2020 and was given 12 to 18 months and then, sadly for us, only managed 8 months, it meant that you had to live in the moment, for the moment, as much as possible, rather than trying to project into the future.
Mm. People's kindness during Joan's illness was very important to you. I mean, I think sometimes it can be difficult for friends to know what to say. Mm-hmm. What helped for both of you and for people listening to this who have a friend who's going through perhaps something like that and they just don't know where to start? What would you say to them?
Well, can I preface this by saying that the only time that Ollie and I had a real contretemps with Joan was...
That's your daughter, Olivia. You call her Oily.
3 weeks after she was diagnosed, she was determined that nobody should know about this because she had the fantasy that she could carry on working remotely or via FaceTime. And we said it is too much of a burden to carry this secret because, for me, secrets are toxic. And I dealt with too much of that in my growing up years. People want to help you and to show that they can, that they love you and all of those things. So she reluctantly agreed to this and was then astonished by the avalanche of support that we got, from flowers to people bringing ice cream. Nigella Lawson sent us food. She cabbed over food that she cooked every Sunday, you know, which was practical, loving and extraordinary. And
so people should just do whatever they can, say whatever they can, start a conversation.
And don't cross the street and think, oh, if I say something to this person, they're going to fall apart like a blubbering jelly. Don't ignore the fact that that person is either ill or that that person has died. Because if you ignore it, it feels as though that person's life didn't count or didn't register. And that feels more hurtful. And I find it very difficult not to be judgmental towards people who flatly react as though it's never happened.
I think we better have some more music, Richard. Your seventh choice. What have you got?
And oh, my goodness. This is Eva Cassidy's version of Sting's song, Fields of Gold. I've known Sting and Trudy Styler for almost 40 years. And, you know, I think he's a great singer-songwriter. But when I heard Eva Cassidy's version of this, it has never ceased to reduce me. It's the best interpretation of his song that I've ever heard.
You remember me when the west wind moves among the fields of barley. You can tell the sun jealous sky when we walked in fields of gold. So she took her love for to gaze a while.
Eva Cassidy and Fields of Gold. It's such an emotional track, that, Richard. And you know, obviously, hearing the songs that you've chosen so far, there is that thread of emotion in there. I wonder if music's been an emotional support to you in your grief, in this moment in your life.
Yeah, it has. And I'm sorry I've been unable to sort of hold it together listening to that. But I think it's because, especially that song, that version of it, is that I have no religious conviction whatsoever. So, but the fantasy of finding that person that you've loved again is what you what you long for. So I have found all to answer your question, music is the emotional wallop or the key to understanding everything in a way that goes beyond language. Sorry, I've fallen apart.
No, it's understandable. And that's what music's for, I think. It's to express the things we can't put into words.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we give you all 8 discs to take to the island. You need them. That's the bare minimum.
Well, Why did I choose that one? Goodness me. Undone.
Honestly, it really started me off.
Okay.
So, Richard, looking to the future and to your next chapter, you've had a hugely varied career, hugely successful one. I wonder if there's anything left on your wish list, a role that you've yet to play.
Oh, I have a fantasy that Quentin Tarantino is going to cast me as a sort of sleazy lounge lizard Vegas singer. But that has never come to pass. But that is what I would like. And to be in a Western.
Oh, I would watch the hell out of both of those films. He could maybe put them together. He's done that before. He's done Westerns.
He should.
So, Richard, the time's nearly upon us, or should I say you, because we're going to cast you away to the desert island. I wonder about the practical side of this endeavour. Will you be able to fend for yourself in this new landscape?
Absolutely. I'm used to trying to solve problems and be practical because of where I grew up. There was no B&Q that you could go to get stuff sorted out. You had to make do. I'd be ready for anything. And I love the heat because of where I grew up.
Well, we'll let you have one more disc before we cast you away. Your final choice. What's it going to be?
Well, this is Barbra Streisand singing Don't Rain on My Parade, which is a battle cry for anybody who has been told, no, you can't in your career. It's really the motto that I think any actor can identify with, of when you're told no, keep going and keep trying. So her interpretation of it is absolutely extraordinary, as is the final note.
At least I didn't fake it, hats, guess I didn't make it. Get ready for me, love, cause I'm a comer. I simply gotta march my heart to drum. I know nobody, no, nobody is gonna rain on my
Don't Rain on My Parade, sung by Barbra Streisand from the film soundtrack to Funny Girl.
I have a 2-foot-tall sculpture of her head, which I told her that I'd commissioned when I had this 2-hour conversation with her.
How do you slip that into a conversation? Casually?
She said, you know that you're crazy. And I said, yes, I know. No, she said, no, you are crazy. And I said, I'm happy to be crazy. That's fine by me. But so I see her every day. She's in my garden.
How wonderful. And she's going to be on the desert island with you. So, Richard E. Grant, time to cast you away. I'm giving you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare to take along with you to keep you busy. Which other book would you like?
Alice in Wonderland. I first read it when I was 7 years old, and I also had the LP, as they were called then, with Joan Greenwood doing the voice of Alice and Stanley Holloway doing all the male voices. I've read that book every single year without fail subsequently, and it is unofficially the most clear understanding of the English class system and the English imagination and sense of humour of anything that I've ever come across. So I love it for all of those things.
You can also have a luxury item. What do you fancy?
Oh, I'd like a piano, please.
Do you play well?
I don't play well, but I play by ear. And being at the sea with no piano tuner, it would certainly acquire a honky-tonk quality, which my piano at home has now acquired because of the central heating. So I'd love that. Keep me entertained all day long.
Oh, it's yours. And finally, which one track of the 8 that you've shared with us today would you rush to save from the waves?
When I Fall in Love by Nat King Cole, because it would remind me of my parents in the best of their time together and of my wife and our time of 38 years together.
Richard E. Grant, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hello. I hope that Richard's happy on his island, playing away on his honky-tonk piano. We've cast many actors away over the years, including Dame Judi Dench, Tom Hanks and Sir Michael Caine. You can hear their programmes if you search through our Desert Island Discs programme archive or on BBC Sounds. The studio manager for today's programme was Jackie Marjoram and the producer was Sarah Taylor. Next time, my castaway will be the epidemiologist Professor Jean Golding, founder of the Children of the 90s study. I do hope you'll join us.
Hello, Desert Island Discs fans. I'm Dr. Michael Mosley, and I want to let you know about my new podcast, Sleep Well. In each episode, I'll focus on a scientifically proven sleep technique and guide you through it, all to help you drift off. It's designed to be listened to at bedtime or anytime you want to really unwind. The idea is to get comfortable, listen, and let the cares of the day fall away. We'll take a sonic deep dive into the body and encounter some incredible sleep-related mechanisms at play. From the breath to powerful neurochemicals to the power of light. I hope you'll subscribe to the podcast on BBC Sounds.